Now, when the war ended, this changed things drastically in terms of what the need was for styrene.
Yes. I drifted right back into plastics. And still, as an assistant to Willard Dow, I organized the plastics department. And here again, he gave me all kinds of accountable freedom. When we moved out and built a new warehouse, and in the warehouse we built our PTS, our plastics, this was Bill Goggins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was in the same place, the same story, and all the office building, everything responsible for plastics was about 2 miles away from the main office. And one time somebody asked me, well, how much autonomy do you have in order to have a separate department and not be interfered with too much with the president and the vice presidents and all that? And I said, oh, about 2.5 miles.
That's excellent.
But it worked. It worked very well, and we were left alone pretty much. And to some extent, the same system then was used by the Dow Chemical Company to organize the chemical department and other departments of the company.
I wanted to talk a little more about that how you organized that, but before I forget, there's one minor thing that I read about. During the war, Matheson gave a talk on the possibilities of splitting the atom, and followed by a visit by the Secret Service.
Yes, he gave a talk to the American Chemical Society, in which he pointed out the possibility of a nuclear bomb. And just one day later, I think, or maybe 2 days later, we had the FBI in asking how in the world did Matheson know about it. Well, he knew about it because he was a darn good physicist.
Where did he get his information that he put that talk together? Was he...
He himself. He couldn't have got it anywhere else, but just... Well, I shouldn't say no place else. He got it in... He went to school and he got his doctorate degree in... University of Michigan,
okay. And
went to school in Canada, in London, Canada. I don't remember the name of the university. But he got the idea himself and what he knew about it and what he had read about it. I'm sure he had read what the Germans had published quite a bit about the fact that it was possible. German scientists, not the German government.
Right. That was an interesting... how quickly the government managed to find out about it.
I should say so.
The main thing I wanted to talk about, though, was your trip to Germany to investigate their synthetic war program. Could you tell me something about how that came about and
this
your experiences there?
This was a part of the army. It was under the supervision of the army, and it was called the Technical Service Corps. And the idea was, and it was organized primarily to follow the troops into Germany, right behind the troops, even before peace was declared, and find out what their industry was like, and what they made, and how they made it, and bring us back to the United States. In other words, bring back all the technology you could find and get. And my own part of it was a synthetic rubber program, of course, and what they did. That involved styrene, of course, and polystyrene, and that sort of thing.
Now, who were the others in your group?
Dr. Bill Goggin and Dr. Hirschkin. Hirschkin was from California, Pittsburgh plant, Pittsburgh laboratory.
Okay, now Bill told me that they were looking at the plastics industry, but he didn't pay much attention to rubber because there was, I guess it was your group that was looking at at rubber, so they tried to separate the
That's
separate
right.
the two.
And we did get, when we got to Germany, we got all mixed up anyway, but he's right, that was it. And I don't remember who else, I remember Leonard Hashey from Tennessee Eastman was one of the rubber, synthetic rubber people. And I don't remember whether there was anybody else or not. I don't remember that there was. But he and I were. Oh, then the in general, this didn't happen all the time, but in general, the English went along. They also had a group, and we went together. So we had English counterparts.
I see.
And we were called, as Bill probably told you, we were called Capon Colonels.
No.
we were given a sort of a synthetic colonel rating in the Army. If you were captured by the enemy, this would give you the status of being a colonel and being an army officer rather than a civilian or something like, or being a spy.
I see. How were you selected to go on this team? Did it come out of Washington?
Or? Came out of Washington, and I guess I don't know any more about it than that it came out of Washington in a letter to Dr. Putnam.
And when did you leave for Europe?
I was in Washington waiting for more than a month, about 6 weeks. So, and peace was declared the Japanese war was still continuing, but the German war was over before I got there. So it was that right in that period. It was probably May when I got there.
Okay, May 45.
And we flew across Pan American.
Or a commercial plane.
Well, it was Pan American, but they were entirely Army.
I see.
And we had the old bucket seats you sat in.
And where did you start then when you got... Did you go to England first?
England first, and we were pretty thoroughly briefed there. And then we flew into Leipzig one time. And I think Frankfurt or someplace like that the second time. And then the Army, we were under the supervision of the Army, and they furnished a jeep and a driver.
Were you there then in Germany?
I was there about 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
Maybe 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me something about some of your experiences, where you went, what you saw?
Well, the most interesting experience was in the Leipzig area, because that's where the Russians came in, and our contacts with the Russians, and how they acted even at that time was probably the most significant experience we had. On one occasion, and I forget the name of the river, but it was a river that divided the two, the Russian territory from U.S. and England and France territory. But anyway, we wanted to see visit a plant which was ethyl cellulose, or at least it was a cellulose plant across the river into the Russian territory. And so we stopped at the Russian gates and asked them and got permission. They finally gave us permission to go in, and we went in. And I think Bill Dawkins was along with me that time. But anyway, they loaded us in a jeep and we took us to the plant, and we just had started to interview the manager of the plant when one of the group that came with us, I don't remember who it was, pulled out his notebook and started to write down the notes. And the Russians said, "This is it. Get in your jeep and go home." So we got in the jeep and went home. It was all right to listen, but you don't take any notes.
Were you generally accompanied by soldiers when you went into these areas?
Only a driver.
Only a
driver who would be a private.
And where did you stay? Did the Army provide you with...
Yes, the Army told us where to go, and usually it was a private home. A private home that the Army had taken over, and the Army had used for their officers or people, and they still were. In many cases, we had Army officers there at the same time we were. But that's where we stayed. We were given rooms.
And how did you find the Germans that you interviewed? Were they cooperative?
Very friendly, very willing to tell anything that they knew. I guess they felt that it was to their benefit to do that, and one of the ones we interviewed in Frankfurt, I think it was. Anyway, that doesn't matter. But he had worked for Dewey and Aumey in this country and had he had gone to Germany and joined the Nazis. But he was also willing to talk, and of course he could speak. Everybody we talked to practically could speak good English, reasonably good English.
Did you speak German?
Only a little, a very little. I could read German pretty well, but I couldn't speak it.
Did you have any surprises? Things
no,
that they had been doing that.
No, a couple of times I got very nervous because I was in the middle of a plant all by myself, and nothing but the German workmen around me, and I kept wondering, well, what are they going to do to me? But they didn't do anything.
Were you wearing a uniform?
So it was just
Were you wearing a uniform? So that
yes, I was wearing we were permitted. We couldn't carry arms, but we were permitted to wear a uniform. And we didn't have any side bands or anything like that to show we were colonels or anything.
How much damage had there been had been done to the plant?
That's a good question. Two ways to look at it. In Leipzig, where the Air Corps was in at the same time we were there, and they were establishing the damage and how accurate there were. And this is primarily information I got from them, not what I saw myself, although I did see a little of it. But they said they were able to be sure that they wouldn't hit anything more than three miles away, and that it just went from the concentration where they tried to hit to 3 miles away. And that the concentration was just like that. And the other part of that, I forgot about this, in Ludwigshafen, which was one of the big IG plants,
right.
We noticed that one whole section of the plant was just completely detonated. It was gone. And so we asked them, the Americans must have been, or somebody must have been great efficiency for bombing. And they said, no, this was an accident they had. They had a tank car of butadiene and established a leak, and it leaked over this whole area of the plant, and then it blew up. And that had done more damage than all the American bombs. At least in that area it had, I should have said.
That's interesting. What could you assess about their styrene production? Let's say making a comparison to what Dow was doing, what was happening in this country. What were the Germans, how did the Germans compare?
Styrene, which was my primary responsibility. It was amazing to me that two companies starting out is true with at least some basic information on what each was doing, but nevertheless, from that time on, they had grown independently entirely. How completely the same two processes could have been. It was just remarkable. They were the same processes. We used different catalysts. That's another interesting thing about research. The Dow Chemical Company, was responsible through Rubber Reserve, for trying to find a better catalyst for making styrene, dehydrating styrene. And Shell and the oil companies were responsible for developing one for butadiene. Well, it just so happened in our research, Dow developed the best catalyst for butadiene, and Shell Chemical Company developed the best catalyst for styrene. So here was research aimed at different objectives and turning out to be just diametrically opposite. And I think even to this day, those same catalysts are being used for those two things. They may have been modified a bit, but I think primarily they're the same catalyst.
So you didn't really have any information that you could bring back that would have helped Dow Chemical, let's say?
Very little. Mm-hmm. Very little. Very little, either by Hirschgen or Gongen or myself. In fact, my own wild guess on the total effort of everybody who was sent over there was that there was very little that was extremely valuable.
Did you write a report? The Goggin Group, of course, has this.
I wrote a report. Leonard Hashey and I wrote a combined report. And there again, I don't have it, but the company must. Washington, D.C. must.
Yes. No, it would be nice to get a hold of that report.
Yes, it would, because it did tell you how to make styrene, and while we didn't say so, it told you how to make, how the Americans made styrene, too.
It's interesting, just as an aside, because on Monday I was in north of Chicago talking to Ernst Vollweiler, who was president of Abbott Laboratories.
Oh, yeah.
And he had been in Europe at the same time investigating the pharmaceutical company.
Well, I'll be done.
So I've had three people on this trip who are all involved in that same
thing. What was his name?
Ernst Vollweiler. He was president of the American Chemical Society in 1950.
Yeah, I don't think I met him over there. I don't recall.
But he may have been a little later. I don't know if he was there.
I met two people who were investigating the food end of it and how the Germans were managed to eat and stay healthy. But they were different. They weren't pharmaceutical.
Yeah, he was looking specifically at the pharmaceutical.
Uh-huh. I probably wouldn't have met them.
What I'd like to do now is come to that point after the war. You said you were still special assistant to the president after the styrene production stopped. And this is when you organized the technical sales group. I'm not quite sure about the titles that evolved through that occurred as this group evolved, and what your role was in that. And I'm interested in that organization.
My role, and actually I moved out to this warehouse we built, which had also the tech service and development and the warehouse, and right behind it was the polystyrene production, right essentially in the same building. Our flow was from the monomer right through and into the warehouse. So my office was there, and other than that, and being assistant to Dow and being responsible for the plastics development, that is what he had given me as a responsible to do. That's about all there was. Then there was the head of a sales department. He was also in this same building and quite close to me. So we had production right behind us, and sales and TS&D and manager of the plastics department, all in this one building, one complex. Now, of course, we had to work then with Texas and the monomer production there and all these other things too, and all the other polymers and the Saran and the production of Saran and that sort of a thing. But it all was in this, centralized in this one building.
Now, the Dow, he had given you the responsibility of seeing that the styrene plants got into operation. Now, when you came back from the European trip, did he give you these, did he change the focus of your work? How did he approach that with you?
Well, here again, I think, as I remembered, I assumed it. Now, I must have told him, and he must have agreed, mm-hmm. which is the same thing as him telling me to do it, I guess. But at Dow at that time, you could assume responsibility for practically anything. Mm-hmm. And as long as he knew about it and agreed, and you didn't make too many mistakes, you were okay.
Now, in your mind, were you looking at, here is Dow producing all of this styrene, and now the need for it has disappeared. Were you looking at creating an additional need for that styrene capability?
Yes.
That how that whole program got started?
That's how the polystyrene program got started, was knowing that there'd be a large excess, a very large. Actually, it didn't turn out to be, because the synthetic rubber program went on, and there's still a lot of synthetic rubber made. So it didn't turn out to be nearly the surplus overflow of styrene monomer that we had expected it would be.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you go about setting all of this up then? Can you describe some of the development that occurred, let's say, through sign that you became research director? You headed plastic, I'm not sure I have the terms, the titles right here, but you headed plastic sales, was that the...
I headed the plastics department.
Plastics department, okay.
And actually, it was a complicated sort of an arrangement, and the only thing that made it workable was the fact that I was his assistant too, and he had delegated, the president of the company had delegated this responsibility to me, because the head of plastic sales line responsibility was to the sales department, the main sales department, and the head of the sales department. So mine was a heavy dotted line, and the same thing with research. Research was done all around the company, and for plastics, I had a heavy dotted line to all of this research, and so on. TS&D and sales. Well, TS&D was pretty much Goggin, and he was part of our organization right there. And of course, that made a beautiful tie-in with research. No matter where it was, we had the in-between the customer and the research.
Yeah, I found this paper that you and Goggin wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Which does, there was a symposium, an ACS symposium.
I remember now. I didn't remember.
this was 1948.
And as I remember too, there was something said in this paper which didn't help when we had our lawsuit on polystyrene with McCurdy.
Oh, really? Can you tell me something about that?
Only that it's pretty hard to say anything. McCurdy, who was the one who distributed so much of Dow's technology everywhere, left Dow in 1958 when the Dow Chemical Company had a bad recession and everybody was supposed to reduce their force 10%, their help 10%. And McCurdy felt that he had, incidentally, McCurdy was my brother-in-law.
Oh, really?
But McCurdy felt that he had a good organization. He felt he'd kept it trim. He had laid off people who weren't doing the work right. So he said to the company, I'm the first one. Just take me and keep the rest of them. So he left the company, and that's why he left and how he left. Mm. I don't think it really hurt Dow. I think competition was good for them. Mm-hmm.
You became, get my date straight here, research director.
I was vice president before I became research director.
1950, I guess.
That's about right.
I'm not sure how I want to ask the next question. How did you see managing research? You had come up through doing a number of things yourself. What was your approach to managing research at Dow in 1950 when you were given, and how did that title come into being? How did you acquire that position?
See, Warner Dow had died, or he was killed in a plane accident, and Lee Doan had taken over, and Lee Doan simply felt that he was not trained and capable of directing research as Warner Dow had been before him. So he is the one who decided that we needed a director of research, and he is the one who appointed me as director of research.
And
now, how I managed it, I think pretty much I felt that the director of research should be responsible primarily for the record keeping and the research accounting, and I went in pretty heavily for research accounting and the ability to say, well, this lab was effective and productive to this extent, and the return on investment in this lab was such and such, and that lab was such and such. But other than that, and we had this all charted. In my office, we had a chart room with one person responsible for keeping the whole thing up to date and bringing in all the records from everywhere, so that we had lost time accidents, patent applications, issued patents, everything charted that you could think of, including return on investment on each lab and return on investment of total research. And then the amount of process and product improvement research, the percent of basic and pure research, there's basic and process and product improvement and customer research. Application research, I guess, is a better name for it. But I rather felt that it was my responsibility to know what was going on everywhere, to get around personally and visit each one of these labs at least twice a year and talk to the people there. And generally speaking, this was also part of the chart room, but I had pictures so that if I was to visit the Western Laboratory, I had a folder which showed the picture of everybody working in that laboratory. It just helped me to get their names straight and know who they were a little better than I would have if I had walked in cold. So that sort of a thing, visiting first that much, but then keeping really good records of what was happening in every lab and the company as a whole, and having this so that if anybody criticized research, I could at least bring them into the chart room and set them down and show what was going on and why. And then we had a research advisory committee that met every 6 months, and they were the heads of every laboratory in the company. And I think at that time we had about 30. And they would come in and we would review in the chart room everything that was going on, everything. We didn't hold anything back. Whatever the lab showed on the charts, we showed them what it was. And one of the interesting things, the most profitable laboratories, generally speaking, this was not always true, were the little labs that were lost out in the production plants, right out in the middle of production, with the worst facilities, and where you would have said they just never would have done it. But they were the ones who were the most profitable.
That's amazing.